Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
What's up, bosses? Welcome to episode 117 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I am in a new country, Sam. I have no idea where you are either.
I'm in a new state, and it is wet, cold, gray, and pretty miserable.
Wow.
It's not a good time of the year to be on the east coast of the USA unless you're in Florida, but I just drove up to South Carolina.
Okay.
So it's winter here, no snow, and not a whole lot of fun either.
Well,
where are you, Johnny?
I just arrived in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia today.
Mm.
So I actually realized that even though I've been here maybe three or four times, I never really spent any considerable time here, more than a day or two. Yeah. So this is going to be my first time checking it out and seeing what it's about.
Are you there just for a visa run, or are you going to stay for a little bit of fun?
I'm staying for 10 days.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm kind of killing time between Chiang Mai burning season and me going to my next destination. And I'm going to be hanging out with the German girl here for a week.
Oh. So. Okay, interesting. Yeah. Well, for anyone that goes to KL, including yourself, I'm sure you've done it before, even if you've been there for 2 days. But one of the coolest things you can do is just go. There's a restaurant, I think it's called The Traders, that's across from the Petronas Towers. And you can go up to the rooftop at night and just stare at the Petronas Towers when they're lit up. That's one of the world's coolest sights. I'll tell you, that is awe-inspiring, my friend.
Well, that's cool. I'll definitely put that on my bucket list. Or maybe bucket list, I guess, to-do list for this week. Mm-hmm. One thing I really wanted to do while on the plane from Chiang Mai to KL was watch The Big Short again on the plane.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've seen the movie years ago and I really loved it. And I was like, I need to catch up on it again. Because now that we've had Danny Moses on the show, or we're going to have him on the show, I was like, I need to catch up on his character, but also just the story itself.
That movie is awesome. I'll tell you, the way that they break it down and make it easy to understand, a very difficult subject, easier to understand, and super entertaining show. So I'm excited to have Danny on. You know what we're going to be talking about, Johnny?
What? What are we going to be talking about?
So Danny was kind of the guy that put in the trade for The Big Short in the movie, of course. And that movie is all about kind of the collapse of the U.S. economy and what sent us into the Great Depression. And now Danny is calling The Big Long. And I'm sure you might have an idea what that is. Not cryptocurrency.
It's going to be cannabis.
It's going to be cannabis.
I can see that happening. I can definitely see that happening. And let's talk about more about that on the outro on if we plan on investing in cannabis or not. But I think it's also going to be fun. I hope you guys definitely talk about the movie a bit and his, you know, what it was really like. Because, you know, Hollywood always kind of exaggerates a little bit. Some things, but it's also based on a book. So definitely ask him about, you know, how factual, you know, Hollywood got the movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just watched it the other day, nice bottle of wine, and it's an awesome movie to catch up on. And it's educational. You learn a lot, but it's entertaining as hell. So if you guys haven't watched it, get out there and watch it. Fantastic movie. I'm sure most people listening to this probably have seen it.
Yeah, but definitely go watch it again. And as you said earlier, like how they will cut away and explain complicated terms like, you know, like what is a CDO, or and they would cut away with having like Selena Gomez or Anthony Bourdain talk about it.
Right. Yeah, that Django scene really helped me understand it all. But we'll probably chat about that in the episode as well.
Yeah. So definitely I encourage everyone to watch this movie again. We're, you know, excited to have one of the guys that the book and the movie is actually based off of. He was one of the guys on the team, on the main team, actually. So that's going to be really fun. And I'm curious what the Big Long is going to be about and what cannabis is going to be about. So we can talk about all that in the outro.
Absolutely. So you guys hear it from Danny himself. Hope you enjoy this episode. Everyone, welcome back. I had a great guest on today, Danny Moses. Danny, pleasure to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Man, I'll tell you, you know, I've watched a couple of your interviews and you seem like you're a much more intense guy in real life than you are in the movie. And I'm just wondering, like, were you actually really sitting back at the office talking about your pronounced case of epididymis?
epididymis or whatever I have, the extra layer of my testicle. No, so in the book, obviously, I'm much more aggressive. And in the book, you know, how you going to fuck me was what I was saying to the traders. And it was a very intense period. In the movie, for whatever reason, which is fine, I was kind of played by this British actor, and I always kind of wanted to know where the nearest restaurant was. For some reason, I was fascinated with Nobu. I'm not quite sure why, but a lot of the method actors that played Steve Carell played Eisman, obviously, and Jeremy Strong played Vinny, and those guys were coming in and shadowing us, like, in the office, and my guy just kind of showed up in New Orleans on set, so we, great guy, it is what it is, but I guess the way my part was written was I was kind of the mild-mannered traitor, but no, anyone that knows me knows that that was not the case, but yeah, it was fun. It was fun anyway.
Yeah, it was. I'm sure almost all the listeners have seen the movie. For anyone who's not familiar, and actually there was a little confusion with me as well. So there's a book, there's a movie, but all of this is based mostly on a real, you know, certainly real events, but how much of it was based on kind of real, you know, everything was real about it?
I mean, the book is obviously 100%. I would say Michael Lewis did about as good of a job that I can tell, considering I lived it and then read it. I read a lot of kind of nonfiction business books, and some of those people actually know characters, and this was probably the most accurate that I've at least personally had a chance to experience. The movie was obviously, you're selling tickets, different than selling books. And obviously I was never chased by an alligator. We did knock on doors, obviously. Trying to think what else. I won't comment on the stripper scenes. This can be interpreted any way you want.
Could be another episode.
Exactly. We'll do a whole another episode on Welcome Front Stage. No, so, you know, a lot of it was accurate, again, but when you're in the movie, there was no one in a bubble bath, obviously, in the book. But no, it was an interesting time period for sure. And I think, listen, to try to explain CDOs the way, so the guy that does Anchorman does Big Short. If I told you that would be the case, Adam McKay could pull that off. You probably thought I was crazy. Wow. But we did kind of help along the way. With just some of the verbiage and so forth. But it was all in all, it was a fun experience. And to be chronicled like that, we never let it really get to our heads. It was just kind of a one-off experience. And again, I can speak for at least the majority of people on the team at the time, is when it comes to Wall Street, and it isn't so much how intelligent you are. I think it's how, you know, aggressive you are, but it's timing. You have to be lucky. And there was a lot of luck involved in the sense of that phone call that came in. That was actually pretty much true. And it's just got to be right place, right time, kind of create your own luck. And then it's what you do with it. So that was kind of the experience. But yeah, the movie was kind of just the hangover of, not hangover the movie, but the hangover of what actually occurred, because it happened. The movie was obviously several years later than what was experienced. So it was fun to look back on.
It was entertaining and super educational. I found that actually that scene with the Django set really helped me understand the mortgage market and how they can basically, you know, of course, crumble, which was illustrated in that scene. Was there anything like that actually occurred in your office that helped everybody really wrap their heads around what could potentially transpire?
No, other than using, you know, a whiteboard in the office of explaining things, we didn't use the Django. But again, that was Adam McKay's brilliance of explaining to a crowd that didn't really understand it, how if one piece collapses, the rest of the structure collapses. And I would kind of, I would equate that meeting to a meeting that we have with Moody's. And in the book, it was Vinny and I that went down to Orlando to this conference, which preceded the Vegas conference. So this was kind of in the fall of 2006. And we met with Moody's, and we were walking through the structure on paper. And we asked them the question, like, what happens in a down home price scenario? What is in your model for triggering, you know, these kind of, and they said, we don't have one. And so when you think about it that way, you just pull the Jenga piece out. That's all you really needed. But no, that was more figurative than literal, I guess I would say. But again, that's the way you had to explain it. So
much of the movie was just kind of the uneasiness in between when after the trades were made, and then it didn't seem like they were working out. At what point, was there ever a point that you guys were like, shit, this is, we just have way too much exposure and this is just not going to pan out the way that we thought it was?
So the Michael Burry character that Bale played, Christian Bale played, he had that experience of, you know, closing his fund, not honoring redemption request because he felt that was the best interest of the investors. And he was right. We were very lucky. I mean, literally from the day that we put that trade on, the next statement that we got, literally the next day or a couple of days after, we were already making money. Again, it's all on paper. When you're dealing in fixed income instruments, it's paper. Now, remember, we had an equity portfolio. So we had a lot of longs. We were long a lot of stocks. We were short a lot of stocks. And then we had this concentrated short bet on CDOs and mortgage-backed securities. All three were working for some reason. And so you're right. There is a psychological impact when a trade goes against you and how long you can hold on. Fortunately, that's what I mean about getting very lucky. Maybe even it gave us a false sense of confidence. But we kept adding to the position because we were experiencing gains, and it just all worked out. So I can safely say, and I think my partners, at least most of my partners would agree, that if we had had the Christian Bale experience, meaning the Michael Burry experience, we would have closed out the positions for a loss and never been able to realize these gains because our investors that were with us put money with us to invest in equities, not in mortgage-backed securities. And so we wouldn't have the bandwidth that Michael Burry had. So in that sense, we didn't feel the pain. And for that reason, I think we got lucky and got bigger than the trade than we even would have been, just because it created a sense of confidence.
Wow, what a series of events. And the Mark Baum played, or Mark Baum played Steve Eisman, I believe it's, yeah. So what was the principle behind him holding out so long? Was it really that he just wanted to stick it to the banks and just wanted to be part of that event happening?
I mean, it's hard to let go of something that created so much good feeling, if it's possible to feel good, obviously, during a crisis. And you know, it was not lost on us that the world was experiencing pain. We weren't celebrating it. It was a tough experience to be making this money. And it really was making our, you know, obviously we would make money on a percentage basis, but it was our investors that were making money. But the issue came down to, and again, the movie kind of depicted it, but not necessarily. So Vinny and I would basically, you know, these bonds got down to 10 cents on the dollar, right? And when you're, I won't walk through the legal mumbo jumbo on this, but when you're presenting a contract that's in default, you literally have to go to the courthouse steps, you know, file the paperwork, get the money paid over. There's a lot of stuff that goes into that. And we were trying to convince Steve, like, listen, the last 5-10 cents on the dollar, let's give back to the brokers and let them deal with the exit strategy of these trades, because we're not lawyers. I mean, Steve was a lawyer by training, but we're not active lawyers in litigation. We want to understand this process. Let's just not look a gift horse in the mouth. We shorted these things at par, which is the equivalent of 100, right? And covered them at, you know, 5 to 10 cents. And to be frank, all the government programs that were starting to occur, right? When you think about TALF and PPIP and all these acronyms that you can come up with, I was nervous that they could come up with a program that would make these bonds whole. Now, the odds of that were a long shot, but they just didn't figure out. The government did not figure out what was going on soon enough. Obviously, they did what they needed to do with the quantitative easing, all the stuff that you guys saw afterwards. I mean, you were probably in high school, I'm guessing, in that time period.
Just about.
Yeah, exactly. So that was what the reason. So it wasn't I think it was a question of not so much letting the banks off the hook. I think it was just letting go of that incredible experience. And that's really what it came down to, was just a 2 to 3 year kind of wild ride. So there was some emotional aspect to it for sure.
Would you guys say you exited the position at the perfect timing? Because if you had held longer, there's a chance that there wouldn't even been a market left to exit in?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how we could have done much better. I mean, I think if you talk to some people, we could say we could have actually been bigger. The risk limits were still being assessed at the time. How do you factor in your portfolio of $1 billion in mortgage-backed securities that you're paying 2% running for to keep on as a short versus a $1 billion equity portfolio? So a lot of risk parameters were still kind of unknown. So listen, I would not have changed a thing. I can't imagine it going any better or being greedy in any case. I actually think the flip side is true. I think we could have bought stocks sooner and experienced the comeback trade, right? I mean, S&P in March of 2009 got under 700. And it's hard to think clearly when there's nobody buying an asset. They're just selling everything. Yeah. In hindsight, the people that stepped in and bought did great. So there's one thing we could have done. It wasn't so much holding the shorts a long time. It was getting longer sooner. And I think it's easy to say that now. But when you're in real time and the government is literally making up programs by the day, hey, let's do this. Hey, let's try this. That doesn't work. Let's backstop this. You don't even know which asset. There were so many companies that were not related to mortgage that were bailed out in the consumer finance area, credit card companies that were, you know, they have to basically, not to get too technical on this call, but when you issue X amount of credit card paper, you have to securitize it or you can't lend any more money to the consumer, right? So you have to keep freeing up your balance sheet. That market backed up completely. So whether you thought the credit card was going to default and the consumer couldn't pay, that's separate from someone that's willing to buy consumer paper. So whether you're an auto company, whether you're financing washing machines, whatever it is, mattresses, the whole system backed up. So how do you even function in real time in terms of what stocks? Do I buy the stocks? It's at $2 a share because they can't clear a securitization. So again, everything's hindsight, but no, I think we maximized at least the size position that we had on. So
yeah, takes big cojones to do what you guys did, and then also as well to buy and go long at or near the bottom for all the reasons you just said.
We didn't buy enough, like I said, but again, hindsight's 2020. So
sure. Speaking of hindsight, there's a lot of discussion in the movie about the system being fraudulent at the point where it looked like the prices of CDOs wasn't correcting as it should. Then everything kind of fell out, and then there's a big bailout. What's your overall views, the 30,000 foot view of the system now that you went through that experience?
I mean, Wall Street works in a way that if you give an inch, they'll take a foot, you know. So Michael Lewis said it best, and I had a recent interview with him where, you know, he's like, did Wall Street technically break the law, or did they just do things that put, you know, depositors at risk? And when you think about it in its basic form, what the banks were doing was literally taking your deposits and using that to leverage up the other side of their balance sheet. And in doing that, they made a lot of money. So there was no risk. They used shareholder money, if you were a publicly traded bank, right? Shareholder money to take the risk to enrich themselves. And at the end of the day, when all the smoke cleared, who paid the fines? It was really the shareholders. It was the companies. Very few people went to jail. I think what was lost and what was kind of exposed afterwards were the fact that there was these prop traders at each of these banks. And there was two sides to every trade at most of these banks. So there were some that were set up to be short mortgage-backed securities and some that were set up to be long. And the people that were long were also setting up packaging these mortgage-backed securities together in CDOs, let's say, and selling those to insurance companies. But you want to get to the nitty-gritty. It's the rating agencies. Like, everybody had a part. Are they AAA? Check the box. As an institutional money manager, whether you're an insurance company or a pension fund, you see AAA. Now, it's up to you to do the work to prove that it is AAA, but you just assume that these are safe fixed income securities. And no one lifted the sheets to really look underneath, because maybe either they didn't want to believe it or they just wanted to believe that the yields were real. So you were mispricing assets, you know, pricing subprime mortgage bonds. But that's the buyer's fault, right? Someone had to purchase these mortgages to keep producing them. And, you know, the Wall Street banks had credit lines out to all of the mortgage producers so that they could guarantee that there'd be some amount of inventory and supply that they could take and package. So it was all like when the banks cut off the lines to the mortgage originators, like we were sitting in our seats and we could tell that these mortgage originators were in trouble. We knew the end was near because the plumbing had just broken. Right. The plumbing was now broken. There was no more. So there was a lot of indication that was going on. And one of my really good friends was a equity trader at Deutsche Bank, Charlie Sweeney. And we did, as you know, as in The Big Short, Greg Lippman was our fixed income trader. If you want to just keep it simple, Charlie Sweeney had no idea what was happening in the fixed income world at Deutsche Bank. He just saw equity trade. So all the publicly traded stocks, whether it was Lehman, Countrywide, New Century, right? All those, he would just see trades come in and out, stocks trading down, up, and he would be committing capital on the equity side of things. And again, this was another area of loss for many of these banks, not just Deutsche Bank, but the disconnect between the flow of information between the various departments in the bank. So I could go on and on. I probably was a long-winded answer to your question, but there is no short answer to that question of was there fraud? Was there greed? Yes. Was there fraud by according to the law? Yeah, you know, optically, no. Peeling back the onion, I'm sure there was stuff being committed in there. Can't give you a specific example. So
I want to transition into kind of what you're doing now, but in that transition, I'm curious to know what you guys were doing after the collapse, after you guys had the big cash out. Like, what did the next couple months while everything, all the turmoil was going on, what did the next couple months into the next year look like for you?
So it was a wild ride because we worked at Front Point, which, as you know, was owned by Morgan Stanley at the time, which is Chronicle. We were nervous that even though we didn't work at the bank per se, we were owned and we didn't know what was going to happen to us. But so there was four or five different sector funds within Front Point. You know, we were a couple billion dollars out of the 12 billion. There was a healthcare fund. There was an energy fund. There was an industrial fund, all these things. It turns out that in 2010 and 11, after, you know, here we are kind of basking in what was going to be next for us, and that would be probably spinning out of Morgan Stanley and raising money separately in a fund. Our healthcare fund had an insider trader, a portfolio manager, committed insider trading, paid off a doctor for information about one of their positions, was arrested for it, went to jail for it, completely separate from us, but under the Front Point umbrella. So fast forward 6 months after that, a year after that, the entire Front Point umbrella shut down. It was worthless because the institutional money was pulling from Front Point itself, which means that we couldn't survive because the entity itself was kind of collapsing. Our performance was fine, so we just kind of gave the money back. So that was 2011. So took a deep breath for 6 months, and three of us, so Porter, Vinny, and myself, started Seawolf Capital at the end of 2011, which was a long-short financial services-focused fund, kind of what we were doing at Front Point. And Steve Eisman went to start his own firm, Emrys. And we just had different ideas of what we kind of wanted to do. We wanted to kind of stay small and nimble. And I think Steve felt that he wanted to do not just financial services, but macro and other things, which is fine. So that was just a philosophical difference. So we did that for 3 or 4 years, actually 4 years, end of kind of 2016. And we didn't do poorly, or we made money for our investors, just not a lot. And again, I won't go into it on this call, but just know that when quantitative easing is going on in Washington and the economy, it really muddies the water on being able to, quote, pick stocks. And we're kind of value guys and picking stocks from the bottom up. It was a macro tape, so to speak. So everything became just one large trade. Whatever interest rates did, that's what all stock did, right? So so we kind of returned the capital. And then Vinny and Porter went on to, they're currently at a different firm right now. And I decided to kind of just spend time with the family and figure out what I wanted to do next. And that's when I came across cannabis. Was kind of, I already knew about it, obviously, but kind of at the beginning of 2000.
Are you saying that's when you smoked your first joint?
Exactly. Right. So the beginning of 2017, I started to kind of, end of 2016, to meet people involved in the space. And that's kind of where my interest has kind of been focused for the most part over the last few years now. And it's just been wild. And, I was at a conference and had a Forrest Gump moment where I was just getting to really to learn the space last year. And I was probably a 3 out of 10 in terms of being up the curve. And to be honest with you, I'm probably not a 10 yet, you know, but I'm getting towards there. And I'm walking the Javits Center at this conference. And one of my friends who I was kind of leaning on for to meet companies and just learn more, pulls me aside and said, "Hey, there's an investor panel. Someone didn't show. Can you sit on it?" And I'm like, "Okay, I'll sit on this investor panel at a cannabis conference. I've sat on financial services conference panels before." I'm like, "But you know, I don't know what I can answer. I'm not sure. You know, I'm not going to talk out of my ass, even though I'm famous for doing that." But I sit there, and someone says, "Hey, Danny, you were in The Big Short. What do you think of cannabis?" And I kind of look up, literally in a Forrest Gump moment. I go, "It's The Big Long." Like, I just came up with this thing, and it's The Big Long. That's right. That's the guy from The Big Short. He says it's The Big Long. And I did feel that way, and I do feel that way. But at that moment, that was the first thing that came to mind, and that kind of stuck. And so I then had to fill in the blanks, obviously, over the last couple of years of realizing why it is The Big Long, and what is it that really excites me about it the most. So that's kind of fast forward to where I am now.
Yeah, we did a dedicated episode on cannabis earlier in the year. And it came after I was in Miami, and someone had a cannabis edible that I ate, and it was like one of these super powered ones. I this is like a message for kids out there. Don't eat what someone puts in your mouth.
Don't do that.
That's exactly what I did. About an hour later, I didn't feel anything. No, I had to do the episode afterwards because I was so confused about the experience. But I ended up in the ER thinking I'm having a heart attack. It's laced with something. Turns out I'm just having a panic attack. And it was like just a terrible experience. But, you know, I came to find out that the strength of this one was like nothing that they even sell in most of these commercial stores. Like, went out to Denver just to look at the industry and saw what they were selling there. I don't know where they got this thing, but it was like a superpower nuclear edible. But it really scared me. And I'm like, well, is this what the industry's becoming? And it turns out it's not really. I just had a really bad kind of outlier type of experience. But came to start looking at it, then went out to Denver, like I said, and started looking in the industry and really became intrigued because there it is actually sort of assimilated into the local society. It's not disruptive in a way. You don't see people abusing it out in the streets. And it gave me a lot more confidence in where this industry can be going on a wider scale. So with you, like, did you, once you called it the big long, did you immediately jump in and start investing, or did it take you some time to figure out where to start?
Well, I'd already, so I met these guys, Merida Capital. They're a private equity firm within cannabis, and that's how I kind of used them for information and made an investment in their fund. And so that's kind of who I have attached myself with. I'm not an employee, but I have enough money in it where, you know, I kind of want to see what's going on. So I kind of used them as my source of information. I met companies through them, and then I did a lot of my own work. And the truth is that people, whether, you know, to me, it's always important, make a small investment in something. I don't care if it's cannabis. I don't care if it's sporting goods equipment. I don't care what it is, because the only way you're going to force yourself to learn more is to be at risk in something, right? You can say you're going to do work on something, but the minute that your money's involved, it's amazing how motivated you are to kind of learn. So that's with anything. So that being said, I dipped my toe in, my ankle, my knee. I'm probably up to my hip now in this stuff. And it's a mix of private companies, public companies. And what's really amazing is that the access to capital that these cannabis companies, because it's a Schedule I drug still, right? So banks find an excuse to not offer their services in it because they stand behind the fact that it's a Schedule I narcotic. By the way, heroin, LSD, cannabis are all in the same category. Let's just leave it at that.
Wow.
How ridiculous that is. And there's a lot of movements going on in Washington. Things are already obviously happening positively. You had the Farm Bill, you had the midterm elections, you have more states. If you had told me that Oklahoma and states like Missouri would be approving medical cannabis use, I would have told you were crazy, even a couple years ago. But that's kind of where we are. So the horse is out of the barn, and it's really amazing. There's technology companies now. I really had looked when I started at companies that don't really touch the plant. Like, I didn't want to invest in a grower, right? Because I think the biggest misperception out there is you can't make money in cannabis because the price of cannabis will go down. Well, that's true if you just own the grower. But all these publicly traded companies now, what they call multi-state operators, MSOs, are vertically integrated. They own the grow, they own the processor, they own the retail, which is the dispensaries, obviously. And then now you keep seeing these brands. So to your point about you eating a brownie that was loaded, I think there's still a gap of information that people need to know, not just on the investment side, but on the product side. And all that's happening. And so it's weird to see an industry that has outgrown its infrastructure, meaning the products come to market before the consumer really has any idea what is going on. And I'll just equate that to hemp and CBD at the same time, because even though, quote, there's no psychoactive element in hemp or CBD, it's still scary to take a new plant or something that as of a year ago was banned and would put you in jail literally for taking. So, I mean, hemp and CBD have always been viewed somewhat differently than THC, but still, it all comes from the same cannabis plant. And so it's really interesting to watch this Wall Street dynamic meet this, you know, market that's been existing both legally and illegally in the black market for years, right? And so it's fun to be in the middle and watch capital, you know, meet this and try to figure out where to allocate. So it's really interesting.
So that's some of the reasons that there seem to be outsized returns in cannabis. It seems like because capital is somewhat limited, it's got to come from private investors, it seems like, versus banks and larger institutions at this point.
That's exactly right. And as a private investor, you're getting incredible terms, right? So you can ask for mid-teens return on debt that is secured by the land, you know, that the grow is on or the equipment. These companies are all asset rich, at least the companies in the U.S. The companies in Canada are starting to issue more debt. And what's crazy is that all the Canadian domiciled companies, or not all, but many are listing on the U.S. exchanges because it's federally legal in Canada, right? So if you're Canopy or any of these companies up there, you're listing on NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange. If you're a U.S. company, you're forced to go list on the Canadian Securities Exchange, the CSE, which is the smaller version of the TSX, the Toronto Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. And then you're listed on the bulletin board in the U.S. So again, not to delve too you know, deep down the rabbit hole here, but your cost of capital when you're a bulletin board stock, your ability to issue equity at a reasonable price goes down. It just diminishes. So I think what we've seen in the ebbs and flows of these publicly traded stock prices is you'll see, like right now, as we're talking now, the stocks have had a pretty decent run, obviously, from the lows at the end of last year. And one of the reasons is there was not a lot of issuance. And now you're going to start to see a lot more issuance. So the scarcity value of ways to express the cannabis trade as it from an investor's perspective is kind of expanding. Therefore, I don't need to overpay for one stock for the fear of missing out. I can buy another stock because there's many ways now to express the trade, right? There's There's ancillary companies that provide, you know, equipment to the industry that actually provide the vape cartridges, the childproof packaging, mm-hmm. the compliance software tools. It's just really amazing. And the job growth, the tax revenues that should be coming soon, it just checks all the boxes, right?
Yeah.
Economically, politically, wellness-wise. So it's really been it's really been fun to watch.
What categories do you like to invest in within the cannabis? You mentioned that a lot of large companies are already vertically integrated. Do you like to work with those that have the full scale of services and products, or do you try to pick out a niche such as distribution or packaging?
Yeah. So again, the large multi-state operators in the U.S., whether it's an Acreage, an Ianthus, just to name a few, Cresco, there's no debt on these companies. And so one of the things you'll hear is, oh, these companies are expensive, they don't have revenues yet, or, you know, the revenues are too low. You got to look past that and think of the time period that the debt capital markets will open for these guys, and you can recap these companies and the cost of capital can drop. You know, these firms are issuing equity and they're paying high teens, low 20 percentile to issue equity. I mean, just to put that in perspective, kind of 5 or 6% is the cost for a normal company to issue equity. And the cost of debt is predicated on what your assets, how asset rich you are to a degree, and how secure the company is. Well, if I can start issuing debt in these companies, or, you know, the banks, the real banks start offering money, you're talking, let's call it 9-10% type money. From a valuation perspective, that makes the equity values go up tremendously when you know you don't have to issue equity as much anymore. And it's not, you know, dilutive per se. So that's one segment. So I like the multi-state operators in the U.S. The other sector is a company like Kush, KSHB. They are the ancillary provider I just kind of mentioned, right? They do the packaging for the vape. They do labeling. They do the childproof packaging. So they're basically the go-between. Literally every major client, every company out there that produces cannabis and sells it, they're somehow involved in various streams. And wow. So they don't, quote, touch the plant directly. And you're talking about a company that's going to do well over $100 million in revenue this year. Again, trades bulletin board, around a $500 million market cap. So that's a real company. This is not a startup, so to speak. And I feel like they're in a great spot. They're kind of another one. The other ones are really in the private sector. It could be technology companies, that are providing, whether it's delivery services or gig work, in the industry. It's really a mix. So I try to find kind of best in class in each of the categories. And if I were to put them in, you know, like I said, it'd be the growers and retailers. There's a couple brands that I'm involved with. You kind of want to target companies in the private sector that you think may be bought out just because they're going to have shelf space, early mover advantages. And then you want to have a little bit in hemp and CBD. But again, being associated with these guys at Merida, you're getting access to a lot of these deals that most people wouldn't be able to even see. So that's why I kind of feel like I'm in an enviable spot of being able to kind of bob and weave into the sector. So there's something new every day, and some of these companies won't make it, right? Some of the companies won't survive. But the ones that have great leadership, good corporate governance, which I think is always key no matter what sector you're looking at, I think can do very well here. So,
and Merida is a fund that specializes, or at least has part of the portfolio allocated to cannabis.
It's all cannabis related.
It's all cannabis.
Most of it wasn't plant touching, but it's kind of moved towards being, you know, directly involved in retail distribution. Not that they're making the distribution, but companies that they're, you know, investing in are doing it. So it's kind of moved its way through the food chain, so to speak. Literally fertilizer companies, GrowGen's a publicly traded company, Merida owns a piece of that, GRWG, CBD hemp companies, Freedom Leaf, FRLF, they own a piece of that. But the majority of their investments are private. And so, like I said, it kind of runs the gamut, kind of the food chain. New Frontier, which is a private company, is kind of the, I don't know if you want to say Gartner, but they are the most, they have the most data and information. So they're the ones selling information to big pharma, right? Or big beverage tobacco. So that was one of Merida's first, you know, investments there as well. So information is everything in this, in this business, because, you know, the access to it is somewhat difficult.
Right.
It's not as, you can't even advertise in this business, right? So it's really interesting.
Will Merida also invest internationally, like up in Canada or Germany, or are they specifically in the U.S.?
They don't, some hemp in Italy, like a hemp farm there, but for the most part, it's U.S. centric. But that doesn't mean they wouldn't do something internationally. It's just a lot of the opportunity set has been in the U.S. And so there's stuff that is going to end up in Canada or is doing business in Canada, but the majority of them are domiciled in the U.S. So,
Yeah, I started looking at this stuff about a year ago, and we released the episode on it. Everyone is super interested in investing in cannabis. Everyone's just trying to figure out how to do it because, as you said, there's so much information involved, and because it's still gray and the whole category is a little hairy, people don't know where to start. But I feel like the way to do it is to do it with a fund. If you have the ability to do it with a fund that has specialists and analysts that are looking at this stuff all day, instead of just going and trying to pick winners by yourself, because it requires so much insight.
It does.
The average person just has the ability or time to do.
Yeah, and you have to be an accredited or qualified investor, obviously, in many cases. And it's kind of, I'm going to say it's not fair, but it's certainly, there's a reason for that, because you don't want people to go risk their life savings that don't have it to lose potentially, because it is a risky, obviously, investment. But at the same time, I think people use that as an excuse sometimes to not do the research on it. And they just say, oh, if I invest in it, my bank will shut my account down, or, you know, I had a bad experience with this one, so I'm not going to invest in this again. But there are enough publicly traded stocks out there now that if you do the work and you're patient on it, you really study it, there's an opportunity, because the eyeballs are not there yet. And when I say the eyeballs, the large institutional money, the big hedge funds, you know, mutual funds, the hundreds of billions of dollars are not there. They're there personally. A lot of these guys that run some of these hedge funds and mutual funds may be investing outside of their own company, but they may not be allowed to invest yet on behalf of their clients, right, that run the hedge funds, because the risk reward is just not worth it for them to face that kind of scrutiny. So there's still an opportunity if you get in the right names. And like I said, I like these, you know, there was this ETF that came out, MJ, right? And that was mostly Canadian names, and money flows in and out of there. I think it's an 800 million AUM or something right now. That's not a great, it was a great proxy because it was a way for people to kind of, oh, good, I have a way to play it. I think those names are somewhat expensive. They can buy the US MSOs. They just have to buy them on the US bulletin board. And so all the symbols end in F. They're five letters. And you just got to be careful when you're trading them. And by the way, some firms like Ameritrade, maybe E-Trade, won't even let you trade those stocks. So you're right. There's a lot of hurdles everywhere, but if you can get past them, I think it's rewarding. You just got to make sure you're in the right names.
Do you have one or two publicly traded on the U.S. exchanges that you particularly like for a long-term hold?
So one of the MSOs, I like a few of them, obviously, but Liberty Health, LHSIF, is the symbol. I like it. You know, I don't know, the market cap's like $300 or $400 million right now, but they're in Florida and Ohio and Massachusetts. They're in kind of the right markets for growth, and they kind of got slammed. Stocks come back recently, but they got slammed because their association with Apria. They were kind of the spin out of Apria of the U.S. assets, so to speak, if you want to look at it that way. A lot of the same board members. So when the whole short seller report came out, I don't know who on this, you know, who's going to listen here understands that, but APHA was the symbol. Anyway, so guilt by association, stock got hammered. I bought that kind of on the dip. Kush, obviously, KSHB, I think is in a great spot. A couple other of the U.S. multi-state operators, Ianthus, ITHUF, they just closed the deal with MPX Bioceutical last night. So that deal's officially closed. And that's now $1.7 billion Canadian company. So 1.2, 1.3 billion U.S. These are big companies, right? And then Cresco Labs is another one that just went public that I like. So there's a lot of interesting, you know, stocks that are out there and a lot of interesting companies. And I think owning these long term and just putting it away and, you know, ignoring the noise can be a great way. So people's, you know, should just read as much as they can. There are a few things that I would recommend. One of the apps, New Cannabis Ventures, NCV, Alan Brockstein kind of writes every day. That's a great app to download. It's free. And Alan puts out a ton of information, and you can do it both on private and public companies. It's really great. And then on Twitter, Tom Engel, A-N-G-E-L-L. He's up. He writes for Forbes a lot on the space. But those are great sources of information. So if people just want to start doing that, I think that's a great way to just kind of read up on the space. So again, it's limited. You don't read a lot of articles, you know, in the New York Times or in the Wall Street Journal yet on campus unless it's something bad happened, right? There's some corporate governance issue at MedMen or there's something. So again, it's really interesting. So that's kind of how I would navigate it.
Yeah. This has been super fun, super insightful, man. This is really good content. I can't wait to share with the listeners. I'm wondering if you have anything that, you know, with cannabis now emerging, we got this green, you know, gold rush in a sense, green rush, I guess you could call it.
Yep.
Are you looking ahead of this to anything? Does this open the door to other things in the future, gaming, narcotics, prostitution. I have no idea what follows this, but it seems like something certainly will.
I don't think, you know, I think that's too broad. I think when you think of gaming, I think that's a great comparable. So 10th Amendment, right, was kind of the big leg up last year for cannabis, the belief that states' rights, states should have the rights to do whatever they want and be protected from federal law. So whether you're political or not, or whatever the category or product is that you want to buy, sell, or use, that's kind of, I think most people agree, states should be able to do what they want, within reason, obviously.
Yep, I agree.
I won't go into prostitution, although I think it's legal in Las Vegas, but I have no idea. But the cannabis and is really interesting because from an economic perspective, this is why I think the horse is out of the barn. There is no the state revenues and the tax dollars, which is a whole other issue they need to fix, like the tax laws. You can't deduct any expenses, 280E thing. Those things are too big now. There's school systems in Colorado that are now building new auditoriums, literally, and facilities because of tax revenues that are coming in. The biggest category to me is wellness. And so Constellation, you know, obviously makes beer and Corona, right? That's like their biggest product is Corona. They invested the $5 billion in Canopy, right, up in Canada. They did that because they were concerned that in the markets in the United States where cannabis was legal, alcohol sales were dropping tremendously. When I say tremendous, 15-20% type numbers.
Wow.
So I think they may have overspent a little bit, but they made that acquisition. So that was your beverage play. A few months ago, Altria, which is Philip Morris, bought a multi-billion-dollar stake in another Canadian company, Cronos, C-R-O-N. They did it at like 12, 13, 14 bucks a share. I can't remember. Stock's now at 20. But they're concerned because obviously cigarette smoking, which was going down anyway, that other vice is now being replaced by cannabis. So that's two. To me, if you're asking me, not just from a vice perspective, but what is the best category, it's wellness. So if you start to incorporate things in your life, whether it's anxiety or pain, or, you know, and I could tell you that you can drink a hemp and full spectrum hemp drink and get the same benefit you do from Ambien, and it puts you to sleep. If I'm the maker of Ambien, I'm freaking out. And if I'm the consumer, if that works, why would I want to inject a pharmaceutical drug when I can ingest an all natural product, literally an all natural crop into my system, and it does the same work? So the area that is underappreciated that I think is the biggest is wellness. And when we talk about wellness, I think it's much more acceptable to people because it's, you know, not necessarily the psychoactive part of the plant. Although there is a wellness category that is the psychoactive part of a plant. Veterans that have PTSD. Why would you put someone on opioids when you can put them on cannabis with a THC level? Why would you do that? You can't, to your point, you ate a brownie and lost your mind, but it did nothing to you physically. It hurt you. So you can't overdose from cannabis, right? You cannot overdose from it. So I'm not going to go into the wellness benefits. I do know that the drug itself is an anti-inflammatory, that we know. Mm-hmm. And the fact that CBD works in kids with epilepsy, right? The drug actually got approved for that. And it's on the market now by the FDA. Epidiolex. The fact that happened tells you that something good is going on in your body as a result of ingesting it. So the wellness category, I think, is the one that's going to take center stage. And you're going to start to see hemp and THC products in movies and TV shows. And we're just kind of beginning. Yes, it's always been around in pop culture, but it hasn't been in mainstream pop culture. And so that's kind of where I think we're headed. So, you know, I don't think, you know, and I hope all these vices aren't legal. And I just want to say, and I kind of say this with everyone I speak to, smoking cannabis THC variety is not good in people with developing brains that are using it recreationally before the age of, call it 21, 22. I think it's bad for you. Obviously, if there's a reason, I shouldn't say if there's a medical reason from an anxiety-ridden perspective or some other reason, sure. But as everyday usage, I don't think it has positive implications on motivation later in life. So I just want to caveat. I always like to say that because I don't want people to think that I'm just this, you know, person who believes in all uses and cases on this thing.
So. Oh, I grew a e-cigarette business in Europe, and I used to have to say the exact same thing whenever we would do public speaking or announcements of any type. So been through
that. Right, but I really believe that I wasn't just checking the boxes.
Okay, good to know. So, Danny, man, this has been a blast, dude. Thanks for coming on, sharing part of your afternoon with you, and yeah, we're going to take a hard look at this. We'll share all the notes and all of your comments
in the
show notes. And yeah, keep rocking, man. We appreciate everything you're doing. Appreciate the work you've done, content
really
you put
it.
Out, and the stories you make.
You got it. And we'll check back in the future and we'll see if any of this was accurate. But don't come at me if any of these stocks don't start to work.
That's right. No, only if they're accurate we'll come back.
All right, you got it.
Tell me the difference between stupid and legal, and I'll have my wife's brother arrested.
I don't get that line, actually. What does that mean?
Basically, being stupid is not illegal. So, okay. But when the banks do dumb things, it's not actually breaking the law.
You know, I'm back in South Florida, not now, but for the next few months. And South Florida is pretty famous for strip clubs. And so I've been using this movie as an excuse to get back into strip clubs to do research on the economy and investing. So if anyone comes through South Florida and wants to talk about the economy, micro, macroeconomics, we'll go to a couple strip clubs and, you know, we'll do our due diligence.
I kid you not. I was at a strip club about a year ago, and a stripper there was talking about investing in Bitcoin.
So perfect.
And this is when I knew to get out. And I wish I would have actually gone out.
I guess the writing was definitely on the wall. Oh. And these guys certainly found it, as you probably did in Bitcoin.
Although
you bought more.
No, actually, I had stopped buying, but I was still holding. So I was just like, okay, this is not good. Like, I'm definitely not going to buy more. But
if she's holding it, I'm holding it.
Yeah, I don't know. So do you remember where you were in 2007, right before everything, like when everything was going really well and people were, you know, everybody was buying houses and mortgages?
Yeah, yeah. No, I was in college. And I distinctly remember, because 2008, I was out of college. 2007, I was still in. And I was in my fraternity house living there. And I had put most of my money into, like, almost all my savings into, like, five or six mutual funds. Didn't know what I was doing back then. But, yeah, when the first, like, ripples of this thing all started to happen, I remember looking into my account and I had lost, like, I don't know, like 18% or something pretty quick. And that was right when it started to go. And I mean, I didn't understand it, the economy at all. I didn't understand what was happening. I just looked into my account. And then, you know, a few weeks or months later, I sold everything pretty much at the bottom.
Oh, that sucks.
Wiped out. Yeah, it's really sucked wiping out, like, because I worked all through college. I had got those arrests when I was a freshman, but I ended up working all through college. But being able to save a little bit of money and, yeah, having that kind of wiped away as you start to try to find your career is not a particular easy scenario to navigate.
All right, well, let's bookmark that for Sam Marks, Lessons Learned, number
Everyone cry me a river, I want sympathy now.
So I remember in 2006, 2007, all my friends were buying houses. They were all buying brand new cars. They were all getting into real estate, either, you know, in some way, either as an agent, as a, you know, someone giving loans, even as like, you know, those inspectors and just kind of anything real estate related, people were just killing it and making so much money. And I remember one of our friends, you know, he was like, hey, you know, Johnny, why don't you buy a house? And what I can do is I can appraise it for, you know, 120% of the value. You can cash out 20 or 30 grand. And you can do whatever you want with it, and then I'll refinance it for you. And that way, you know, you still have equity in the house, and you'll have, you know, 20 grand cash. You can go out and buy a car. And this guy was driving a brand new 8 Series BMW at the time, like an $80,000 car. And all my friends, like literally everyone I knew, was, you know, would fight for the check. Every time we went out to eat, no matter how much it would cost, people wanted to show off. People were like, no, I got it. And I remember at the peak of everyone balling out and driving new cars, having, you know, houses, and I wasn't that old. I was like, you know, mid-20s. I left for Thailand. And while I was there, the crash happened. But it didn't matter for me because I had no money anyways. So it sucks that, you know, a lot of people lost money, including yourself. I had never had any money in the first place. So it literally just didn't affect me at all.
Yeah, it's interesting because you had graduated college. So I guess the signs to you, now in hindsight, were a lot more obvious. You know, you talk about everyone fighting for checks and all these things that are happening. And kind of like when you were in Thailand, it didn't really matter. And when you're in college, you don't really see the signs, right? Because everyone's just living poor, drinking beer, and no one's driving flashy cars. But once you get out into the real world, especially in big cities, I think you're out in like California. So start seeing those things. And, you know, we'll take that experience through the rest of our lives, just kind of being able to look for signs. But that's on the overheated side. But now we're in this a world with a new emerging industry, green rush, as some are calling it. And I don't know, man, everybody is talking about cannabis. I'm getting 3 or 4 messages every week about CBD investing, cannabis logistics, all types of different things. And I want to get your opinion on it, Johnny. But even some of my college buddies just started a marijuana fund, like a cannabis investing fund. And it's crazy. It's like everybody seems to be getting in on it, making money on it. And I still haven't touched it yet. But
I'm sure you've touched
after this episode, I don't know.
I'm sure you've touched some actual marijuana, but maybe not
because
funds.
I had such a maybe because it's toxic to my body. But I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out the difference in THC and CBD and like how that all affects. Because a lot of people are talking about CBD. I think that's like the safer, both in terms of regulation and also in terms of effects on the body. It's like a little bit more neutral, I guess.
So. Yeah. So basically, in cannabis, you have CBD, which is normally extracted from an oil. That's kind of where all the health benefits are. So every time you hear, you know, something has medical medicinal purposes, reducing anxiety, can, you know, fight cancer, whatever it is, they're talking about the CBD. The THC is the other part of cannabis that is psychoactive. That might have some benefits with, like, you know, anxiety or getting over certain kind of psychological things. But in general, that's the THC is for the recreational part. So the CBD oil, the CBD dabs, the CBD vape pens, things like that are super super good for you in a lot of ways, and there's really no downsides, especially, you know, because it doesn't get you high. So I actually smoke CBD oil when I was in Thailand because I had some inflammation, and it was kind of that gray zone where I was actually able to buy it online legally within Thailand and have it shipped to me. But when I tried to order again, they had their payment processor shut down. So it's still in one of those kind of really weird, you know, systems where CBD itself is definitely going to, you know, hemp and CBD is going to be legal faster. And then THC is kind of trailing along because there's not that many health benefits of THC. It's mostly for people just to get high.
Okay. So if I grew a marijuana plant, that bud that would be on it would have both THC and it would also have CBD component to it, right?
Correct. But if you grew hemp, which is a cousin of the marijuana plant, it won't have any of the THC. It would just have the CBD.
Okay. And if I smoke CBD, what would that do to me? Like in terms of feeling, what would I feel?
You might feel a bit more relaxed and a bit calm, but there's no psychological, it won't make you high. Like it's everything that you think of as getting high from marijuana, CBD doesn't do any of it.
Okay, yeah. So that's one of the guys, like after I went to the hospital, that thing, he's like, oh man, I wish someone called me. I have CBD oil, and that would have counteracted the crazy effects that you were having. So I guess that like balances it out anyways.
Yeah, you know what? I can see that because maybe in like nature, you know, if you just, here's the thing about marijuana is people talk about how natural it is. If you smoke marijuana the way that it grew, you would have to smoke a lot to get high. Like what we're consuming, you know, in those gummy bears, but also just what people smoke, like OG, you know, purple Kush, that's not natural. That's not like bred to be like 200 times stronger than normal, like, you know, like normal dried marijuana that like Native Americans might have smoked.
Yeah, so, it's like, yeah, it's like cocaine and cocoa leaves. You know how much cocoa leaves you have to chew on to like to feel anything? You have to basically chew an entire bucket full.
Yeah,
it's not like, that I've ever, yeah, not that we're going to discuss using narcotics, yeah, but it's the same thing. Yeah. I mean, humans just make things like hyper potent. And that's, I mean, that's why it has to be controlled, right? Because otherwise people go around sticking these nuclear gummies in your mouth and all of a sudden you have half the state is in a panic attack.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm sorry you went through that. But, you know.
Hey, so, I got my HSA set up because of that.
Oh, good.
Because of that experience. Yeah. So it's a net win.
And you lived through it. So good on you. Yeah. And now, you know, never let the landlord stick anything in your mouth.
That's right. Awesome for the children out there.
So as far as, you know, as far as investing in, you know, marijuana, cannabis, what do you want to call it? I think it's actually kind of similar to what we just talked about. It's kind of the Wild West. It's you know, it's kind of uncontrolled right now. It's kind of legal. It's kind of not. I personally think a lot of people are going to, some people are going to make a lot of money. Some companies are going to make a lot of money. And then a lot of companies are just going to go out of business. So I'm glad it's around. I'm glad overall it's there. And I'm happy for the people who invest in it because they're the ones building the infrastructure. They're giving it a head start. And for their risk, I hope they're rewarded for it. But that's not going to be me. Like until cannabis companies get, you know, put into, I don't know, like a small cap value fund or something, I'm not going to be investing in them. What about you?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are hoping that we're jumping in with both feet to some of these things. And I'm just like the episode with Michael Berger. And actually, so I forget what episode that is, Johnny. You might be able to take a peek. But we did a dedicated episode on cannabis going back maybe 6 months ago. And if it's the same thing, like I caught up with those guys recently too. And I mean, they're killing it. They're crushing it. They also have a fund and they just went into one company that was at a $25 million valuation. And a year later it went public at like $1.7 billion.
Okay.
And so that was, think about the, think about the returns on that. What is that? Is that 100 times return or 1,000?
That's a lot. But, it was episode 79. We published it December 19th, 2017. So if anyone invested in the funds that they mentioned in there, I'm wondering how much that went up for them.
Yeah, we'll have to get a chat going in the Boss Lounge on this. I know a lot of people are making money, both publicly and in the public sector and also the private sector. I think there's a lot better opportunity in the private sector, but you need somebody that really understands the industry, the regulations, how things plan to shape up. It's just not me. So I think if I come into some more cash, then I might do like one of these private funds. But it doesn't excite me enough. In a weird way, cryptocurrency excited me a lot more than cannabis. Maybe because I've had a negative experience with cannabis. I've never really liked weed. Maybe the CBD oil is something I could get behind. But yeah, I don't know. It's not exciting enough for me to pull the trigger, even though I know people are killing it out there and the opportunity long term is massive. And I would have to agree. I think it can be the new long, as Danny Moses definitely is making the point. So a lot of opportunity out there. I want to hear people in the Boss Lounge, how they're investing and who's made money from it. I think that's probably the best way for everyone, all of us, to understand what's happening in the industry, who's making money and how.
Well, I took a look at the three kind of ETFs or funds that he mentioned on, that Michael Berger mentioned on episode 79. So the first was Canopy Growth Corp. And that looks like,
but that's just a stock, right?
I think that was a stock, yeah. And
that's one of the bigger ones. Yeah.
I'd have to read us in the episode again, but I think what he had, he mentioned these three as these are like the publicly traded ones. They're easy to get into. They're not they're not necessarily what they personally are invested in. But it looks like all three of them. It was Canopy Growth Corp, Aprahera, and Horizons ETF. They're kind of flat, or like one of them, Horizon, went up a bit, but like the other two were down a bit. It doesn't seem like it's correlated at all with, you know, the growth of the cannabis market in general. But it also could be because there's so many funds in there that some fail and some do well.
I'm sure there's going to be a long tail of the winners and losers in this industry. But everyone that I've talked to seems to still think it's so early that, like you said, Johnny, there's going to be a lot of shakeout, but also with that shakeout, there's going to be massive growth for the winners. So let's go out and pick winners for everyone out there. Pick those winners or diversify massively across some of these new emerging ETFs. And if there's any new ETFs that we don't know about that kind of have a basket of these in a well-managed way, let us know, because that would be really interesting to share as well.
Yeah, definitely. Let us know in the Boss Lounge. If you guys invested in anything or you guys are looking into anything, we can discuss it there. One thing that Danny had mentioned that I thought was really cool was, instead of investing in the actual plant itself or the people who grow the plant, you know, for many reasons. One, it could be it's kind of like commodity. Second, it's just it's like investing in the corn. It takes a long time to grow. There's a lot of things that can happen. What I really liked that he mentioned was to invest in things that are supporting industries. So kind of similar to, you know, selling pickaxes to miners during the gold rush. And he had mentioned a company called Kush, which first has the coolest name. And second, they supply all the packaging because if you've ever walked into a medical marijuana store to buy, you know, anything in there, you'll know that everything needs to be very specifically packaged to, you know, first be tamper resistant, second be like child safe, but third, you know, be able to really kind of like protect it against kind of, you know, being messed with because it is sensitive and it's kind of this new thing. And it sounds like this one company is supplying almost all the packaging and they're probably going to make a lot of money.
Johnny, maybe what we should do is we should put it like $5,000 or $10,000 into a little account together. We should pick stocks and then see if that beats our Vanguard accounts at the end of each year. Because I would say that we probably would lose, but it sounds like a fun idea.
You know what? I think I've been pretty lucky at picking stocks, but I just don't do it. I think the only two stocks that I currently own is Facebook and Shopify. And both of those are up a lot. I thought really hard to buy Facebook during the dip about a month ago. And I think it was in kind of mid end of January at like 145. And that's back up. But I've just decided I don't want to speculate. I don't want to gamble. I'd rather just be, you know, long term in index funds.
I agree totally. That's the strategy and that's the narrative.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was great having star on our show, and it was fun watching The Big Short again. Highly encourage everyone to watch it. If you guys do watch it, it's on Netflix. You guys can talk about it in the Boss Lounge. If you haven't joined yet, just go to investlikeaboss.com, click on bonus, and you can get an invite there if you sign up for our email list. Or you can just bypass all that and just search for Boss Lounge on Facebook, and we will accept you as long as you are a real person and you have a photo.
Yes, sir. And thanks everyone for the reviews. We're sitting at 177, I think. 177 five-star reviews. And they really, really help us. So if you guys have a minute extra after this episode, jump on, leave us a quick five-star review. We'd really appreciate it. And it helps us get a lot of these great guests like Danny Moses.
Definitely. And we would love some more 2019 reviews. We have a ton from 2018, 2017, but we would love some from 2019. So please, please, please go on iTunes, search for Invest Like a Boss, click on ratings and reviews, give us 5 stars, click write a review, and hopefully we'll read your review on the next episode.
Hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and we'll catch y'all next week.
And remember, guys, truth is like poetry, and most people fucking hate poetry.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.